The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia author event series here at Irvine Auditorium. I'm Toby Dichter, honoring my mother, Amelia Gordon, with this lecture, and I chair the Foundation Board of Directors. The Foundation is what brings you the author series and so many innovative programs and services to help new Americans, students, the incarcerated, the entrepreneur, the unemployed, the isolated, the scholar, the young and the older in every neighborhood in this city and around the world through remote access. It is a bastion of democracy. And to keep it free and thriving, we count on private philanthropy. I know everyone says they love the library, but would you please consider showing your appreciation through a donation on our website? So in this digital age, the purpose of the library remains to transform information into knowledge, research into relevance. It's where experts offer their perspective and context to enrich our understanding, and that is the essence of the book tonight. Fascism, a warning. I have an early copy, and I marked 28 jaw-dropping parallels for today. Every one of us should read this book and then send it to a legislator. You and 1,000 other people here tonight and those listening to the podcast know Madeleine Albright for her brilliant mind, steady hand, and unflinching candor. But her biography is amazing. Listen to this. Madeleine K. Albright is chair of the Albright-Stonebridge Group, a global strategy firm, and chair of Albright Capital Management, LLC, an investment advisory firm focused on emerging markets. Dr. Albright was the 64th Secretary of State in the Secretary of State of the United States. In 1997, when she was named the first female Secretary of State and became at that time the highest ranking woman in history of the U.S. government. From 93 to 97, Dr. Albright served as the U.S. permanent representative to the United Nations and was a member of the President's Cabinet. She is a professor in the practice of diplomacy at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. She chairs the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. She is also president of the Truman Scholarship Foundation and a member of an advisory body called the U.S. Defense Department's Defense Policy Board. In 2012, she was chosen by President Obama to receive the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Honor of Freedom, in recognition of her contributions to the international peace and democracy. Dr. Albright is the author of 5 New York Times bestsellers, her autobiography, Madam Secretary, a memoir, The Mighty and the Almighty, Reflections on America, God, and World Affairs, Memo to the President, How Can We Restore America's Reputation and Leadership, Read My Pins, Stories from a Diplomat's Jewel Box, and Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948, in which she recounts the story of her Czech childhood under Nazi invasion and Soviet occupation. This latest book, A Warning, was published yesterday, April 10th, 2018, and how privileged we are to have her with us tonight in conversation with the excellent Dick Pohlman, writer in residence here at the University of Pennsylvania and the national political columnist at WHYY News. It is with pride and admiration we welcome Dr. Madeleine Albright and Dick Pohlman to the author event series of the Free Library of Philadelphia. Thank you. Great.
Well, thank you all on behalf of Madam Secretary for being here. This is, you draw quite a crowd, right? That they even had to move us to a bigger venue. But I think before we start, I think everybody should join me in thanking Madam Secretary for her service to our country. Well, as far as I can see, I just checked my tech Twitter before we came out here, and I saw that Robert Mueller still has his job. Yeah. So we're up. I think we're up to date on this. Let's just talk a little bit about the book in one sense. A lot of people here have not seen it yet or opened it, and it has a very provocative title. And I know the word fascist gets thrown around a lot in our dialogue in this country, and has for years, often in an extremely reckless, hyperbolic way, but you mean it in a very, very precise way. So let's define our terms first. This is about, correct me if I'm wrong since I read the book, it's about people who will try to hold power by any means necessary. That's probably a little bit simpler than you might want to explain.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming and listening, and such a terrific audience. I love coming to this city, and thank you very much for being so welcoming, and thank you. So I am careful with the term, and you're absolutely right, it's thrown around a lot. Whenever we don't like somebody, we say they're a fascist, or your son might call you a fascist for not allowing him to drive the car, or whatever. But it is an unbelievable term in many different ways. And the way that I define it is that it is a person that in fact identifies with one big group at the expense of others. It is kind of a us versus them. But it is this taking on that identification. Then it is somebody who does not think about the legitimate rights of the other people at all. And then finally, somebody that is willing to do anything in order to gain power, including using violence. And fascism itself is a way of exacerbating the problems of nationalism, always kind of tribalism. Then also, if there are divisions in society, doing everything possible to exacerbate those divisions rather than trying to find common ground. Then using whatever information technology at the time is for propaganda, then having rallies that are ones that in fact ultimately are in some ways characterized by some violence or in really encouraging violence, and then not being able to ever see that there's anything that they have in common with the other people. And then finally, the use of violence, I think, to get what they want. But I think it's a hard term to define, and the reason that I even decided to write this is it isn't always the same. There are certain aspects of it, the ones I just named, that repeat themselves, but the truth is every era has its own form of fascism.
Well, let me set up the question that I think is probably foremost in most people's minds here. And let me set it up by reading, this is from your book. You quote someone from a past country that became slowly, very slowly, totalitarian, and a well-educated person. And you said, quoting this person, "To live in this process," this person said, "is absolutely not to be able to notice it. One no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing." So the question that I have that I think everybody wants to know is, how worried should we be?
Well, I think we should be. I really do. And one of the other, I have to say, the book is historical. I decided that what I wanted to do was to look at the history of fascism, and I do write about Mussolini and Hitler, but I also am looking at what is going on in a number of countries now. What is going on in Hungary and Poland and Turkey and the Philippines and Venezuela, and trying to see how it comes upon those countries. But there are some great quotes, and the one that I think describes things very, very well is Mussolini, who says that if you pluck the chicken one feather at a time, then people don't notice. And I think that that is an incredible image, and I think we are plucking a few feathers. And so what I've, the book is not about President Trump. It is really about what the signs are. And I was going to write this book no matter what, because I thought that there were certain aspects of our society that troubled me in terms of divisions. When I came to the United States when I was 11 years old, and what seemed so incredible about the U.S. for somebody that was born in Europe and spent the war in Europe was that this was a middle-class country, and people tried to help each other, and it had a great deal of diversity, which was accepted. And so I was troubled by the divisions that were there and the way that they were being exacerbated. And so I wanted to point to that and to really kind of look at the signs, the feathers.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book, right, the book is not about President Trump. It takes a much bigger picture. Although I have to say my attention was drawn immediately to a chapter which is headed, entitled President of the United States. And I don't know whether it was in that particular chapter or somewhere else in the book where you did call him the first anti-democratic small d, the first anti-democratic president in modern U.S. history. Now, you also say, page 219, I am an optimist who worries a lot. So in terms of him being the first anti-democratic president, how optimistic or lack thereof are you that some of the pluckings that he is conducting right now are going to play out for the worst?
Well, let me just say, I've been asked whether I think he's a fascist. I do not think he's a fascist. I think that he is anti-democratic, however, by instinct. And one of the things that bothers me, and by the way, I was told the book would come out on April 10th, it didn't occur to me about all the things that have been happening in the last 48 hours that really kind of work in terms of explaining what's going on. So one of the big issues here is that he doesn't seem to understand the importance of the freedom of the press, that is the basic aspect of democracy, and deciding that to call the press the enemy of the people or fake news is really very, very damaging. The other part that I think makes me nervous, and I am an optimist who worries a lot, but the worrying about understanding of the institutions of democracy, the importance of checks and balances, and what he has done in terms of really being very denigrating about the judicial system and using invective to talk about judges and trying to talk about the Justice Department and the kinds of things that are going on there, the aspect of how he is treating a respected officer, Mr. Mueller, who has had an incredible reputation, and just kind of sacking the kinds of things that he says. So that. And then I do think this kind of sense that he does not respect people that disagree with him. The idea of no civility in terms of discussion that goes on. And I do think this concept that it isn't us versus them. And then I think trying to find a scapegoat. And what he has done is to scapegoat immigrants and decide that they are either drug dealers or rapists or terrorists. Which is truly un-American. And so those aspects are what I worry about. And therefore, I then worry as to whether we're paying attention. And so this book, we've all seen that saying, see something, say something. I have added to that, do something. And so I decided what I would do would be to write this book and then make clear from my perspective what needs to be done. And I do think that we have to call it like it is and say that we don't want a president who thinks he's above the law. And I think we want to have more people involved in running for office, there's a responsibility in democracy to be active citizens and to really see that going on. And then also to have civil conversations with people we disagree with. I so believe in bipartisanship and proved it by being really good friends with Jesse Helms. But I do think that part is very important. And then I really think we need to support those children that march so that there can be...
I appreciate an audience who knows who Jesse Helms is at this point. I think that's great.
That's true.
So what do you think then explains the apparent fact, if you look at the preponderance of the credible polling that's out there constantly, that regardless of all the things that he has done, and you've listed a lot of those authoritarian tendencies, he still commands, if that's the right word, he would certainly want that word, between 35 and 40% of the public. And it's like it barely budges, no matter what he says, no matter what he does. What do you think, because, you know, I guess with authoritarian countries, there's going to be some kind of basis of support for what these leaders do. You know, what explains that loyalty? And is it a symptom of something deeper that's wrong?
Well, the reason that I was, as I said, thinking of even writing this earlier is because I think we need to accept the fact that there are some very unhappy people in this country who feel that they have been neglected, that as the situation has changed in terms of technology, that they are the losers, that they have lost their jobs, that our education system has not prepared them with new skills in order to be able to participate, and that there are a bunch of elitists that are there, and that not enough attention is being paid to them. And I think that we know in all societies there are divisions, and there really, I think, is the responsibility to find ways of mending all of that. And I was just going back, because I've been asked in terms of, have there been other periods like this? Well, the Great Depression was a period like this. And we had a president, FDR, who was attacked both from the left and the right, but he was able to find common ground. Instead of what is going on now, which is exacerbating those differences and making it seem as though nothing, that Washington is a swamp and that the system doesn't work. And I think that as somebody, I so believe in the American system, and I spent my life either working on the Hill or in the White House or talking about executive legislative relations, that is a very basic part of our system. And I have to say it's not very inspiring at the moment, as there's not enough work being done or results. And let me just say, I stole this line from Silicon Valley as a professor. I have to admit it's plagiarized. Is that what has happened everywhere is that people are talking to their governments on 21st century technology. The governments listen to them on 20th century technology and provide 19th century responses. And so there is no faith in institutions, and that is where the problem comes.
Yeah. I heard an interesting statistic today, a true one, that Trump's voters, the counties that Trump won nationwide, accounted for only 36% of the economic output in the year 2015. Only 36%, which I think explains, you know, these are small towns, a lot of, you know, left behind, Rust Belt, you know, this, we know Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, et cetera. And those used to be communities, working class. Those used to be communities that were the linchpin of the Democratic, at least the Northern Democratic coalition. So, I mean, one of the things I wanted to ask you was, to what extent has the Democratic Party helped put us in this pickle just by not paying sufficient attention to these, to people who they used to, who used to count on the Democratic Party to sort of be on their side?
Well, let me just say I am a card-carrying Democrat, obviously.
Hence the question.
But let me also say the following thing. This book is about much more than the past election, but what did happen, I did spend a lot of time in Pennsylvania. I was in Philadelphia, but I also went out into the countryside, and you could see what was going on. It wasn't just the cities, the mill towns or whatever, but in the rural areas where there was just a real sense that nobody cared about them. And I think that one of the hard parts that I found is I was trying to understand what motivated the people that did not like my candidate or the Democratic Party. And I think that in many ways we lost contact with our base. We are a labor-based party and have been, but there was a disconnect. I have worked in politics a very long time. There may be people that actually remember Ed Muskie. I worked for him.
I remember him.
Yeah. So, and I've been very a proud Democrat, but the bottom line is there has been a disconnect. And I think that there are these issues in terms of, you know, are we too much into identity politics and don't understand enough what the changes are in the United States? The bottom line also that I've noticed is that people are very derogatory about the term populism. The truth is that democracies are for the people, mm-hmm. populism, and that it's not a bad thing. It is basically a way that the, you know, you're either an elitist or a populist. I would prefer to be a populist, frankly. And I think that what we need to do is remember what the whole thing is about. People form a state, as we all know. The social contract is that individuals are willing to give up some of their rights in order to be protected by the state and have roads fixed and you pay taxes. That's the price of living in a civilized society. And I think that the social contract has been broken and we have forgotten what our responsibilities are to everybody in the country. And I think the Democratic Party did lose contact with the base.
Well, another factor, and you mentioned the press earlier. Let me give you a slightly different press question, see what you think about this. I spent earlier today, part of the day, with a terrific journalist named Alec McGillis, who has worked for the Washington Post, and he's on this great site called ProPublica, which is a nonprofit website that does investigative reporting. And he spent a lot of time, he goes back to the Midwest all the time. He really believes in looking at this area between the coasts, where the seedbed of some of this authoritarian thinking, or at least indulgence, took place. And what he points out is that a lot of the local news sources, the traditional small town newspapers, you know, they've been drying up out there. You know, there have been cutbacks after buyouts after cutbacks, and a lot of these towns that used to have tons of local reporting, they don't have it anymore. And so a lot of these voters, certainly in 2016, but we're still thinking ahead to 18 and 20, that vacuum has been filled by social media. And so they're getting a lot of their information, in quote marks, from Facebook and people who target them on Facebook. You know, swing voters in swing districts, as we know what's been going on, you know, it's very surgical almost. And I'm just wondering, I don't know, I want to know if you agree that that is a problem, because it's like, you know, we have a robust press in Washington and New York right now, and we can talk a little bit about that in terms of what needs to be done. But outside the coasts and a lot of these communities, it's really been drying up. And I want to know if you agree with that, and if there's any, I don't know if there's pushback on what Facebook does, what can be done to at least, you know, reach people with reliable, credible information, keeping them away from, you know, the stuff that just sort of feeds their anger.
Well, and I think it's very hard, because what has happened is that, first of all, there isn't that local angle, but people only listen to what they already agree with. It's kind of in echo chambers, and there's not enough of an effort to learn what other people think. You should all be very glad you don't live in Washington, because I live there and I drive and listen to right-wing radio and yell and scream a lot, and someday I'm going to be arrested for giving people the finger. So, I think it's very important to listen to things you disagree with, and there is a tendency not to do that these days. I do think one of the scandalous things was something that happened, I guess, a week ago when the Sinclair people distributed the same talking points to all the local papers. And one of the issues, to go back to fascism, is the use of propaganda and using whatever the technology of the day is in order to spread the word. And so that is certainly what happened that Hitler used Goebbels to do that. There's always something. And I do think that the modern technology is the most incredible gift to us in terms of the capability of knowing more than just our local story. But it is also as a double-edged sword in terms of the way it is used to provide just only what people listen to. I probably shouldn't say this, but I have done a lot of TV today, and everything seemed to be going fine. I did Fox. You should see my Twitter from the Fox listeners, you know, and criticizing the person who interviewed me, and why would they have such a horrible person on that's such a liar. And so there is this kind of tendency that there are those who only listen to what they already agree with, and if you have somebody else on, then it's kind of disquieting. And there's not this thing in terms of, and which is one of the things that I stated, is there has to be respect for other views. And a fascist is somebody that aligns himself only with one group and has no respect for other views.
Yeah. You know, there's one other thing about today's technology. Well, you know, maybe it's too hyperbolic to say that Facebook today is what radio was in the 30s. You know, perhaps, but I get, you know, it worries me. And one of the other things about social media, this is a point you were making in the book I hadn't really thought about, which is that the speed, you know, the sheer instantaneous speed of social media and getting everybody cranked up in the moment, that people, and this is a quote from the book, that we're so cranked up by social media and the immediacy of the technology that we have, that the risk is that we lose patience with democracy's sluggish pace. Well,
and that is the problem.
It's a culture. It's a deep cultural thing, and how to get past that.
Well, I really do think, and I'm trying very hard not to be derogatory about generations or other people, but I really do think that there is kind of the sense of instant gratification and reality TV and all the things where all of a sudden you don't have to spend a lot of time analyzing something. There is something that happens instantaneously. And that is very troubling, and I think that there is this tendency to just absorb something and then go on to the next thing and be entertained. What is going on in the world is not entertaining. It is very troubling, and does require a lot of thinking. And part of the issue, and you mentioned it, democracy is slow, I think, in solving problems because it has to absorb a lot of information, try to balance, try to find common ground in some way, and understand that there are different, you know, compromise is not a four-letter word. And so the bottom line is that seems to have gone out. And I do think that the problem is that there is a certain amount of chaos in democracy, and it's hard to figure it out, and people get very impatient, and problems are not being solved. I have tried very hard, for instance, to analyze what happened in the Arab Spring. And so it was very exciting in many ways, and it was social media that got people to Tahrir Square. So then the question was, how did they get from Tahrir Square to governance? And they had all been gathered there through social media, and I obviously believe in elections, but those elections, I think, were held too soon because the Muslim Brotherhood was organized and the people in Tahrir Square had all their, they were in their echo chamber. They were disaggregated. They didn't want to form a political party. And meanwhile, the Muslim Brotherhood wins in the election. What goes on with the government there at the time, Morsi, not much was happening. There was disorder, because there were still the people in Tahrir Square. So I made up this kind of, in analyzing it, the mythical middle-aged man who lives outside of Cairo, who wants to come in and open his stall in the souk, and Cairo's a mess and he can't get there, and he says, to hell with this, I want order. So then you get Sisi, a general, and you have order, and he has just gotten reelected. And so there is a messiness to democracy, and people do want some order. It's only, the problem is that fascist order is a capital O, that it really takes over everything, and then the resilience and inventiveness and very imaginative aspects about democracy kind of go by the wayside, because people don't want to live in a state of upheaval, and they want some kind of easy answers. And I think the original question that you asked is why, in fact, this base keeps sticking with Trump. And I think that because he does provide some entertainment, if you like that kind of thing, and also because it does, he keeps saying he's doing something, and there are these simplistic responses, and people continue to doubt whether anything is happening. And part of the issue, frankly, is when even I, a great lover of the executive legislative aspect, Congress doesn't exactly look like it's doing a lot. And I have gone to the Hill very much telling them, this is Article One time. The first article of the Constitution is about the power of Congress. And they need to do more. That's what they were elected to do. That's what has to happen.
Presumably that would include legislation to protect Mueller's job, which I understand the Senate is going to reintroduce.
Yes, they are.
Tomorrow?
I do think that there are some senators that are pushing that. I was listening to Senator Coons this morning talking about that. I do think that there needs to be that. There also does need to be bipartisanship. And what was very interesting, I have spent a lot of time on the Hill recently because I've been appalled about the budget. I happen to believe in the State Department, because if you're going to do diplomacy, you need diplomats. And so there are Republicans that are willing to understand that. And as I said, I do believe in bipartisanship, and they do have to do something. And the gridlock is, this is where we're in a vicious circle, because then it does undermine the whole concept. I believe in the following thing, which sounds completely contradictory, in the resiliency of democracy, but I'm concerned about the fragility of democracy and the one feather at a time. And so I think we need to understand the resiliency means that it takes a while, but the fragility is also something we have to absorb.
Yeah, something you said a few minutes ago about wanting easy answers. And I thought this was one of the things, of course, this was only clear to some of us in hindsight, that Trump was scoring with people who really liked that. You know, when he kept saying, things are going to happen really fast, he would say that a lot at rally. Things are going to happen really fast. I'm going to do this. It's going to happen really fast. And people, this idea, oh, my God, there's the sluggishness of democracy. We're finally going to clear all that away. And sometimes I wish I wasn't a student of history, because, you know, I heard stuff like that, and I found it disturbing. There was something he said after the Parkland shooting, and he had some people in the White House, and they were talking about gun ideas, curbing guns, different ideas. And he came up with something. I don't remember what it was. It wasn't particularly worked out. But then he said, when he finished what he was saying, he went like this. He went, problem solved.
Yeah.
And that was like, problem solved? You know, this is like the beginning of the beginning of the beginning. You know, but this is what people relate to. What I can't understand, this is another question I have for you. Why do the congressional Republicans, talk about Article One, why do congressional Republicans, why have they just like become completely belly up this entire time with all the things he's doing, saying, well, we don't really pay attention to the tweets, we don't know what he tweeted the other day, et cetera, et cetera. You know, what explains that behavior? Are they scared of the base that is sticking with him, as I say? Is it just political pragmatics and nothing else?
Well, I do think that some of it does have to be connected with being scared of the base. We do have midterm elections coming up. And I think that there are the problem that those that might wish to be more cooperative with their Democratic colleagues are concerned about the far right than running against them. But if you look at what the elections have been, some of the extra elections recently, you would think they'd see something else. But I think the bottom line is that they are concerned about that. And then this is where I think, to go back to something that I keep stressing, we cannot normalize the behavior that's going on now. Exactly as you described it, a president who says, I've solved it, when the next day he changes his mind and there's a different solution. And one of the other parts, again, to go to some of the characteristics of undemocratic behavior, is absolutely convinced that you are the only person, a stable genius, that can actually solve everything. And I think the part that has surprised me, this kind of sense, is the U.S. government, I know from experience, makes thousands of decisions a day. And it requires cooperation among the departments. It requires people that are government workers, that are good, patriotic Americans, that work on the issues. There is no way that one person, a president of the United States, can solve the problems of the country. And just the fact that there is not a kind of, you've got to be kidding, when he says that, I think that we have to really watch that. And that is one of the characteristics. Mussolini actually thought he was the most powerful person in the world when the Pope just lived down the street. And so there is this kind of sense of infallibility that I think is very troubling. Yeah. The other part that truly bothers me is the transactional aspect of everything. What is interesting, however, and I wonder in terms of the base on this, the tariff situation that President Trump has now done with the Chinese, I think the ads that are running that are of the people, the agricultural community, that is saying when the tariffs went on soybeans and various things, that have ads saying this is hurting us and this is his base. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how that has worked out.
I think he addressed that the other day and said, I don't know, maybe we'll give them a tax cut or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and what struck me about this, thinking about just about being so powerful, during the one line during his convention speech in 2016, when he said, "I alone can fix it."
Absolutely.
You know, and that one that got that got my attention.
But I do think that people do want somebody to fix things because things are not working in a number of different ways. And to go back to one of the things we were saying is, I do think that there are large numbers of Americans who feel that they have been left out and that we have not paid enough attention to them, and that the technology, rather than helping them, has taken away the dignity of their work, and that we as a society have not adjusted to their needs. And I do think that that is something that we have to look at and not look down on them, but figure out what it is that we can do as a community to be helpful and to find common ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the next Democratic nominee, you know, really has to address that, you know, for the good of the party, for the good of the country. I think that should be imperative, but you know, I hope they don't fight it out too much.
Yeah.
There's a school of thought out there that some said sometimes jokingly that he can't really be a successful authoritarian because he's too incompetent to pull it off. And that's the saving grace. But let me segue into foreign policy a little bit, because I think as an example, he said during the campaign, and he said constantly, I'm not going to, in terms of foreign policy and national security, I'm not going to telegraph my moves to other countries. Obama did that. Of course, Obama did everything wrong, but Obama did that. So I'm not going to telegraph my moves. They're not going to know what I'm going to do. That's not the way to deal. And then last week, he kind of put it out there. It was however it got out there. He was thinking of, you know, we're going to pull everybody out of Syria, which is telegraphing a move. And I think, and now the other day, or maybe it was yesterday, can't even remember now, he said, watch out, Russia. This might have been in a tweet. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Watch out, Russia. The missiles are coming. So I'm thinking, all right, now he's telegraphing his moves. So, I guess the bottom line of that is like, you know, does he know what he's doing? Of course, that's dangerous in and of itself, you know. But does he know what he's doing enough to be calculated enough to be authoritarian?
Well, let me just say, I do think that the situation internationally is as complicated and difficult as anything I've ever seen. And it requires a basic knowledge, knowing where the countries are and who is running them.
Slip that one in there.
But I do think that I agree with Senator McCain, who said that when he said, I'm pulling everybody out, that it enabled Bashar Assad, with the support of the Russians and the Iranians, to do this horrible bomb, the chemical attack in Syria. And what this requires is action that is in cooperation with other countries, understanding how foreign policy works, having a team. You know, he has a brand new team, and on the first day of John Bolton's appearance, this is when all this stuff began happening in terms of back and forth. So I am very worried about this, and I do think that you know, people might ask, how do I get away with writing about this kind of thing and what is happening? I decided in my to-do list and why I felt that I could be a good messenger on this. This is no secret to anybody. I was born in 1937, meaning that I'm 80 years old, and this is called the Antiques Roadshow. And my background is that I was born in Czechoslovakia. And as a result of leaders that decided they wanted to solve a problem quickly, the British and French made a deal with the Germans and Italians over the heads of Czechoslovakia, the Munich Agreement, and sold the country that I was born in down the river. And I think that is something that one has to really watch out for. Then, as a result of fascism, 26 members of my family died in the Holocaust. And I think that we need to understand what happened as a result of fascism. And then we need to know and look at what the symptoms are, what the feathers are, and that we need to understand that there are things that lead in the wrong direction. And therefore, I am writing this book because I do think it's not to panic, but as a warning of the things we need to look for. And when you have a leader that does, in fact, think he can solve everything by himself, is willing to change his, or led to change his mind in terms of whether how he treats, you know, one of the things that came out and Neville Chamberlain said about Czechoslovakia, why should we care about people in faraway places with unpronounceable names? So why should we care about people in the Middle East that are subjected to chemical attacks in faraway places with unpronounceable names? Now, this isn't just humanitarian, because what is happening, the people that can escape there from there then go to Europe first and are migrants. And then there are people like Viktor Orban, who in Hungary has decided on ethnic purity and doesn't want any migrants. And so then that is a real impetus for him all of a sudden to come up with a term called illiberal democracy, which is an oxymoron. So the bottom line here is that there is a reason why we should care about what is happening as Putin separates our allies from us and undermines democracy. And so that is where I'm really troubled, is that we are not having enough explanation of the complications of the world and how they affect America. And I think that we need to know more from our leaders about how they see what the international problems are.
Well, you mentioned John Bolton a second ago. Is he as scary as his image or his mustache?
Yeah.
No, serious question. Is he as scary as
his
image?
Well, let me just say, I have only run into him once. And what happened was that when I was named Ambassador of the United Nations, it was obviously during the transition period. And what happens normally is that the transition period is very interesting. Either it's, some people think it's too long because it goes from Election Day in November until January 21st, or that it's too short because it really is kind of turning over the crown jewels and learning what's going on. So he was the person, he was an assistant secretary for international organization. And so his job was to brief me as the new ambassador. He was so awful about the UN, I thought, why would I want to go there? And the various positions that he had in the government when he was the undersecretary for arms control, it was like putting the fox into the chicken coop because he didn't agree with anything. And then he went to the UN and was unbelievable towards everybody. So, and then what I'm very troubled by is the kinds of things that he has been doing and saying while he's out of office. And it is not a character, the way he operates is not the major characteristic that the National Security Advisor should have. That is the job for somebody to be an honest broker, to bring the ideas from the various departments together, to offer options to the president. But the issue that is so important is the National Security Advisor is usually the last person to see the president. And the thing that we happen to see in President Trump is that he actually listens to the last person he talks to. And so I think I am very concerned about that. And I'm hoping that, in fact, John Bolton will understand what this job is really about. But in the last 48 hours, three people have left the National Security Council. And so there's a house cleaning going on. There are no people at the State Department. So the question is, how is foreign policy being carried out?
All right, here's a question for you. And this dovetails with what you were just saying. All right, so imagine that President Trump was going to have you over as a dinner guest. Because, you know, you're at least as wise as the Fox News talking heads that he's been inviting over. And he comes in and he says to you, look, I don't know, this Russia scandal is driving me crazy, but I know that I've got to show that I'm at least showing some strength against Putin. The thing with Russia is so complicated. The scandal's going, the investigation's going on. But we've got to do something, and I've got to look strong and smart, as he likes to say, with Putin. What, Madam Secretary, would you advise I do? Because I really need any help I can possibly get. What would you tell him?
Well, I think that obviously the relationship with Russia is very difficult. But I think the thing that he would be smart in doing is understanding that Putin is trying to undermine our democracy. And that he needs to forget about, you know, he's afraid to talk about any of that because he's concerned about the legitimacy of his election.
Right.
But in the same point is he's undermining what is his tool, frankly, in order to be able to look tough, to say, we're not going to put up with this. You cannot come and use our democracy in order to undermine it or what you're doing with our allies. I do think that finally he has done something that is important, is to institute those sanctions against the oligarchs around Putin. And it has really, I think, they are people that are linked to him. And it was something that Congress wanted. And I'm very glad he did that. I was a little bit, frankly, positively surprised in the way that, even though it was through a tweet, that he blamed Putin for some of the things that were happening in Syria. And now he has to be able to push in order to make sure that there's a real investigation about what's going on there. And it doesn't mean, let me just say this, I think that people think if you've got a relationship with a difficult country that you only punish them, that you have to have some kind of diplomatic contact with them. You have to look for areas where we have something in common while pushing back on the things that we disagree with. And when they do something like annex a piece of Ukraine or have little green men all over the place and put pressure on the Baltics, then you don't have, frankly, a press conference with the three presidents of the Baltics and talk about your own problems. And so I think the issue here is to pick the places where it matters to the Russians about what their behavior, and that we're watching it, and he has to be tough. And I think it's conceivable that maybe some of the things that are going on in Syria now will make him turn and understand that the Russians are a genuine problem for us.
All right, let's see what we have here from folks out beyond the lights there.
Yeah.
I like this just because it's completely different from all our heavy talk here. What is your favorite book?
Well, in all time, I have to say that my favorite book is War and Peace, because I think it really is a remarkable book. By the way, I know that when we all first read it in high school, the girls liked the romance and the boys liked the battles. But it is something that I quote from an awful lot in terms of how a system works and the relationship of how different the military was. And one of the things I quote a lot in class is, in fact, a way that Tolstoy talks about the fact that the higher you are in a government, the less you're able to determine what you're doing. And very much, and how we think that we're in charge of things and we really aren't. So I use that regularly in my class.
Someone wants to know what pin you're wearing tonight and its significance. What pin did you wear when you met with Putin?
Well, first of all, I don't know how many people know the beginning of it. I clearly like jewelry. So what happened when I got to the United Nations, in 93, I was an instructed ambassador. And my instructions were to make sure that the sanctions stayed on Iraq. And so every single day I said something terrible about Saddam Hussein, which he deserved because he'd invaded Kuwait. And all of a sudden there was a poem in the papers of Baghdad comparing me to many things, but among them an unparalleled serpent. And so I had a snake pin and I started wearing it whenever we talked about Iraq. And so then I thought, well, this is fun. And I went out and I bought a lot of costume jewelry to depict whatever I thought we were going to do on any given day. So on good days, I wore flowers and butterflies and balloons. And on bad days, a lot of carnivorous animals. And so the ambassadors, the others, got used to this. And they said, what are we going to do today? And I said, read my pin. So that's how it all began. But I do have to tell this story. It's the evening and it gets a little racy. But what happened was that there's this crazy picture that during the 50th anniversary of NATO, that President Clinton and Secretary Cohen and I were sitting in the green room, and somebody started the hear no evil, see no evil monkeys. We look like crazy people, and it ended up in Time magazine. So I then decided, we were on our way to Moscow for the summit, that I went and I bought three monkey pins. And we're walking into the summit, and President Putin turns to President Clinton, and he says, we always notice what pins Secretary Albright wears. Why are you wearing those monkeys? And I actually said, because I think your policy in Chechnya is evil. And he got furious at me, legitimately. And President Clinton looks at me like, are you out of your mind? You're the chief diplomat, and you've just screwed up the summit. So that's when pins got me into trouble. But pins also got me out of trouble. So as the first woman Secretary of State, I did invent the art of diplomatic kissing when I arrived. You can't visualize Henry Kissinger or Jim Baker giving. So, and it's much more complicated than meets the eye, because the Latins, some kiss on the right cheek and some on the left cheek, and so I'd get mixed up, and the French kissed on both cheeks, and the Dutch three times, and then there was Yasser Arafat, just the thought, right? So, I went to South Korea, and I had a great meeting, a big embrace with the South Korean foreign minister, and then I get home, and I get a call from a journalist, a Korean journalist, said, don't you think the foreign minister should be fired for what he said about you? And I said, well, what did he say? And he said, well, I really like it when Secretary Albright comes, because we're about the same age, but I'm this tired old man, and when I embrace her, she has very firm breasts. So what do you have to say about that? So I said, I have to have something to put those pins on.
Is that the racy part?
Yeah, that's the racy part. So the pin I'm wearing tonight was given to me as a present, and it's Mercury, the messenger. And I really do think that this book is about a message that I'm hoping. It took me a long time to find my voice. I went to college. I went to Wellesley, which is a great college.
Yeah. There's a Wellesley in here somewhere.
But I went to Wellesley sometime between the invention of the iPad and the discovery of fire. So things were a little different. But I really And as I mentioned to you, I did want to be a journalist. And it wasn't until I was 55 years old that I had a job representing the United States, and I found my voice. And I knew that I had to speak, otherwise the voice of the United States would not be heard. So now that I have a voice, I'm not going to be quiet, and I am going to be the messenger.
Well, one thing, you know, we have time for just a couple more here, but actually someone here said, you are awesome. You may disagree with that, but someone said that. So, one thing that you don't get into in the book, correct me if I'm wrong, is the issue of impeachment as a potential long-term solution to this drift we're talking about. Do you believe that the tendencies or actions he has shown thus far constitute grounds for impeachment?
Well, I do. I'm not a lawyer, but I do think that there's the whole question about obstruction of justice. And I do think that that is one of the issues that they should be looking at in terms of, and it has goes back to what Mr. Mueller's doing in various ways and the kinds of things that are going on. And I do think that the job of president is one that requires you not to be above the law. And that is the part that bothers me. But I do think that this is a very difficult time. I think that there needs to be a sense of responsibility by those whose job it is to do that. But I'm not going to prejudge that, but I do think that there are legal aspects that need to be looked at more. And as I watch TV and I see the really hard work that many of the members of Congress have undertaken in order to do investigations about what happened on the whole Russian issue and our election, and they are not being accorded the respect and the right of a minority to have their views heard. The thing that I think we keep forgetting, democracy is about majority rule, but minority rights. And that's the part that we have to remember in terms of the way we voice our ideas.
Yeah. It seems to me, I mean, there's always this debate, how much attention, particularly in the press, a debate, how much attention to give to his tweets. You know, you take them all seriously, or you just get distracted by all of them. Are they all worthy of coverage? But, you know, the other day he had one which basically said, talking about the investigations, he said, no collusion, he says that all the time, no collusion, and then he said, no obstruction, and then in parentheses he says, except fighting back. Except
no.
When fighting back. And, no. You know, if I was, I'm not a lawyer either, but if I was Robert Mueller, and I'm thinking, what do you mean, fighting back against the investigation?
Well, I do think that there, again, from watching commentary, I think he has stepped pretty far in terms of implicating himself. But let me just say one of the issues with the tweets that's difficult. I do still travel abroad an awful lot. And as a former diplomat, one of the kinds of aspects is you don't criticize your country when you're abroad. But the tweets and everything have confused our adversaries and our allies. And so, for instance, I was in Portugal and I was asked by a journalist, are you embarrassed by President Trump? And I said, I'm saddened. I keep trying to. But I do think that we are in peril of making even more complicated the international situation and the problems that we have, because there's no way that they can interpret the tweets any better than we can and try to figure out what they really mean. And so people, you know, leaders in other countries kind of say, you know, did he really, what is going on? Can you explain that to us? And I can't. And so I think that's the complication. I've been asked a lot of questions in the last couple of days about Syria. And should there be a response to what happened? I actually think there should be, but it needs to be part of a strategy. You can't do foreign policy by tweets. And that is the worrying part, in addition to the various things that he says in them that confuse the American public.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're almost out of time. It went fast. I'm going to end a little bit where we circle back a little bit to the beginning, where you said you're an optimist who worries, or however you put it. How confident are you that our institutions, the press, the Constitution itself, the judiciary, how strong are they, strong enough to withstand the rattling that they're now undergoing?
I do think they're strong enough, but it requires us to speak out and not to think that this is normal. That's the problem, and I think that people think, well, it'll go away. But there is damage being done domestically and, from what I know, internationally. And so I do think that we are, the Constitution does not say I or me or they. It says we, the people. And what better place than Philadelphia to talk about that? And I really do think that we have to figure out how to make sure that we don't allow the rattling of the cage to make it more difficult. And I do think that that is why we do need to defend the freedom of the press, the judicial branch, and not just the, I'm kind of concerned about the way some of the judges are being appointed. But I'm very interested in the way that the system, again, I'm not a lawyer, I'm just the mother of four lawyers, but basically that there are ways that the various district courts are being asked to assess things, and it strikes me that they have done some very positive things in terms of the immigration issue or sanctuary cities or any number of different things. And I do think we need to look at not just everything that happens in Washington, but our local institutions, and that is where the strength of the people can come. And then I do think we need to keep saying that we don't want a president that is above the law. I am an optimist, but the reason that I'm out here talking about all this is that I am worried that we are going to think, okay, this will end and go away. But it is doing lasting damage, and so I do have see something, say something, do something. And so I'm encouraging people to do something.
So,
yeah. Yes.
This is last remark of the night, I promise, from page 250 of the book.
Yeah.
History tells us that for freedom to survive, it must be defended. So thank you for your defense.
Well, and thank you all for being
all
here.
For coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you so much for your kindness and attention. Thank you. Thank you. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.